This is The Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome to The Business of Wealth. This is Alejandra Stratabolsky, and today I spoke with Luis Seco, who's a co-founder and the president and CEO of Sigma Analysis and Management. He started his career in financial risk management in 1996 while a professor at the University of Toronto, creating the Risk Lab, a research center that serviced the financial sector in Toronto in the area of risk management. Sigma started in 1999 as a spin-off of the research activity at the Risk Lab. He is currently the director of the mathematical finance program at the University of Toronto and the CEO of GGSJ, Center of Digital Management and Technology Innovation, an institution to leverage the international university network to assist students and companies to manage talent and further innovation. Luis holds a PhD from Princeton University, and he was the Bateman instructor at the California Institute of Technology. He has authored numerous papers in financial risk management, investments, and market models, has won a number of research awards, and is an active participant in professional organizations, including AIMA and PRMIA. On this chat, we discussed where the asset management industry got it right and where it got it wrong in terms of risk management. So enjoy. Okay, Luis, thank you for being here and welcome to The Business of Wealth.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay, so our first question is always, very similar. What got you here and what's here? Where do we find you?
I've been doing asset management for a long time. It's very hard to remember what brought me here, but maybe if I go back to my, when I started to my early days, I was a professor, University of Toronto, and then I became active in the area of risk management. I worked with a company, Algorithmics, doesn't exist anymore, but they were bought by IBM many years ago. And then I was attracted to the field of financial risk management. And then one thing led to another. I met my business partner of today, who encouraged me to get into doing asset management from a risk management perspective. And we were probably the first company to do asset management, taking risk into account. And then one thing led to another, and the company grew. And now we have an investment offering worldwide. One thing led to, it's been a long story, and it's just a very long opera with many, many different acts. And we happen to be here, and it looks like the end is nowhere near to be seen. So maybe it's like maybe the Valkyrie of the Ring cycle. There's probably still 7 more hours to go or something like that. So,
oh, cool.
That's how.
What attracted you to risk management? Why the risk management aspect, especially as a professor?
Yes. So I was. I'm a mathematician, and I like structures. I like to think about the world in ways that I can express in a more or less quantitative way. And risk management was just beginning to be, when I got interested in that, was just beginning to be expressed in quantitative terms. So I like challenges. I like that challenge. And then I was attracted to it. I was attracted to the concept of coming up with mental structures that reflect what happens in reality, but not physical reality. Another mental reality, which is the concept of risk in a financial institution, which is some post or something which is very hard to touch with your fingers, right? So one world of ideas with another world of different ideas, trying to bring them together. That, I found it very attractive, and I got interested in it immediately.
So what was the first risk management structure you developed, or what did it look like?
Yeah, so I'm going to date myself by saying this, but the first structure that attracted me was the concept of value at risk, which was, I got involved in this in 1994, exactly when value at risk had been defined. It was the first time that mathematics made it into regulation. Okay, now we're used to that, but a mathematical term which is expressed in terms of probabilities, was actually part of the law of the banking regulation. That was hadn't happened before. So to me, that's how I got started. That was 1984, a long time ago, 26 years ago. Since then, one thing led to another, and then I got into credit and risk management, and I got into hedge funds and asset management and operational risk and all sorts of other things. But it all started with that very old concept of value at risk of 1984, done by J.P. Morgan.
In that growth trajectory, where do you think the industry got it right, and where did it get it wrong?
Ooh, very good question. I think the industry got it right almost all the time. It is just that it never really was complete. I'll give you an example. The Basel I Treaty was launched in 1998, and it was perfect. It was perfect for what it wanted to do, which was to regulate the banks' profile in market risk management. That's what they set out to do, and it was done. What happened? A few months down the road, in August of 1988, is when we had the Russian default and the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which drew markets into a tailspin. And then we had bankruptcies. In fact, one of the biggest credit risk events in the world was London Capital Management. The regulators didn't predict that, but it wasn't the objective of the regulators to predict that. The regulators were trying to fix the problem of 1987, the crash of October 19, 1987. So they fixed that problem 10 years later. And now, the same year they fixed that problem, a new one came up, and that led to Basel II, which was So the regulators and the risk managers are always trying to play catch-up, okay? And so they got it right, but they're always trying to fix the problem that happened.
They're always a little late, right?
Well, and that's the way it is. If you look at the airline industry, a lot of the regulation in the airline industry is because of accidents that happened, right? Very few regulations are done because of accidents that will happen. Or at least this is how we think about it. The reality is that that's not the case. Of course, in a lot of the regulation, you imagine the accident that might happen and you regulate against that, right? Yeah. Just that when the new accidents actually happen, they say, oh, you didn't think of that. You say, that's right, I didn't think of that. I thought of these other 25, but not that one. And then you adapt the regulations, right? So it's a mix of rights and wrongs. I wouldn't say that it's wrong not to take into account the Russian default coupled with a Monica Lewinsky scandal the same week, you know? Who could come up with an event like that? But if you learn from the events that develop and you adapt to that, I would say that you're doing everything right.
So actually, that's a good segue into how could have the wealth management industry predict or not the pandemic? And, you know, what do you think they did right in that sense? And what changes do you see for the future in that?
Very, very, very good question. The first conference that I saw on pandemics and wealth management was actually in Toronto around the time of SARS. When we had SARS, the first voices started to speak about a real pandemic, not that a real pandemic happening and what we would do. And there was a conference and we talked about that. So you could have imagined, going back to my analogy, that this was what allowed us to predict what things might actually look like.
Right.
When this happened. So the theoretical work was done, but then there was no follow-up, right? There was no follow-up. So I think the asset management industry has done a very bad job at that. And the reason is very simple. The reason is very, very simple. This is an asset management industry. The asset management industry, risk management does not work very well within the asset management industry. You know, even the concept of mentioning risk is always something which is very elusive. And who wants to plan for risk? The asset management industry is not compensated to take risk into account, and people don't. It's as simple as that. People do what you pay them to do. It's the sad reality. And in the asset management industry, people are paid to perform. They're not paid to remove risks. If a product doesn't work, you just get rid of it, launch a new one, and then move on, right? So that is one.
That is, I would say, that interesting what you said. Like, go deeper into asset management industries not compensated to take risk into account.
Right.
Okay. How would you like describe that in the sense of an asset manager's relationship with their clients, or
So the asset management, the asset management industry is paid to take risks. Is not paid to take risks into account. In other words, if you take risks and the risks work, either your fund grows and then your income grows, or you get better performance fee and then you grow, right? This is very well known. It's a very asymmetric relationship between the asset manager and the investor. That, right? The investor always pays and the asset manager always makes.
Yeah.
And risk-taking works always to the advantage of the asset manager. When you have a situation where you try to perturb that somehow, that everything becomes very... I wrote a paper a few years ago, which now we implemented into a commercial product. I wrote a paper where we turned the tables, where the investor always makes, never loses, and the asset manager could lose or win, right? That's different. So these situations are beginning to be possible, but they're very unpopular. This is not something that the asset management sector really is designed to take into account.
That's very cool. That is great. So, who will fail in the coming years?
I wish I knew. I don't know who's going to fail in these coming years. But I think that the people who fail are the people, they will all share one thing, which is they didn't generate enough scenarios and they didn't prepare for enough scenarios of things that would go badly. At the end of the day, risk management is all about that. Let me generate scenarios. Let me figure out, before I decide how likely or unlikely they are, let me figure out how bad they would be. I mean, some of them are really bad. Mm-hmm. Let me figure out, before I predict if they will happen, let me figure out how easy it would be for me to protect myself against those. All right. So I give you an example. I have a house, I have a car, and I have my life. Okay. So I want to buy house insurance, life insurance, car insurance. Why do I make those decisions? Well, how bad things can get if three things fail, right? And then I see the insurance, and if it's worth it, I buy it. If not, I don't, right? That exercise, which we do on an everyday basis, are things that people should do. You go into a car, you put your seatbelt. Why do you do that? Well, the law says you have to. But you think about that, it costs you nothing, and as unlikely as having an accident might be, it costs you nothing. So the likelihood of you having a car accident is irrelevant. It costs you nothing to put a seatbelt, right? So the premium you pay is nothing, and the protection you have is potentially huge. That's why you do it, right? So risk management is that. You generate scenarios, you figure out how you can protect yourself against the bad ones, and figure out if you can remove those. If you do that well, then everything you're left with is upside, right?
Right.
Upside. So, okay, that's fine. Upside. So upside is good because it pays you something. It gives you something. It doesn't cost you anything. It's upside, right? So not enough people spend enough time thinking about downside. People spend too much time daydreaming, thinking about upside all the time. And then when bad things happen, they say, oh, who would have known? So, well, it was your job to know.
Right.
So that's how, I mean, risk management, I mean, that's how we think about the world. We think about the negatives always, not because we like the negatives. We hope to be wrong all the time. But when something bad happens, you want to be able to say, I actually did something that protected me when that happened. I have my seatbelt on, or I bought my insurance, or I did what I had to do so that when bad things happen, things are not so bad.
Okay. So where do I find you now? Can you give me an example of, in your role, how you're doing that risk management exercise?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not aiming to be commercial, but it just happened. We launched the fund at the end of December, exactly just a couple of months before the pandemic, which is exactly as our paper a few years ago described, where the investors always win, and when the and when money is lost, the managers pay for that. Then, if things go well, they collect a huge performance fee. It's all very good. So we actually launched that. And okay. Our investors, they were making money through all of this, right? So, again, we prepared for something bad happening. It did happen just a couple of months ago. I didn't know it was going to happen. It was not my job to predict. My job is to prepare. So we were prepared, and then it did. It cost us a very little bit. Of course, in retrospect, it was a very cheap insurance. Right. And then that's how we do what we do. So, I mean, that one thing that I've always done in my scientific career is I always work on problems which are practical that I can actually implement and put to work, right? And in the case of asset management, we put it to work. Exactly on Christmas Eve, we launched this fund.
Oh,
exactly.
Wow.
You know, very, very biblical, you know?
Hmm? Yeah.
And it was meant to save the world, and at least to save our clients. So, so that's how it works for us.
So now in your firm and your role, what's the biggest challenge you're facing right now? In how
well, yeah. So, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, it depends how I understand your question. A big challenge is, you know, working remotely, keeping the team together, making sure that we're doing that very well. I mean, I spend half of my days traveling already, so I'm already used to working in airports, hotels, or, you know, different countries or time zones. I'm fine with that. So this maybe, as a friend, we're managing that very, very well. But the biggest difficulty now is, since we're, we can't travel, it's very difficult to grow the business, to tell the stories to potential investors. You have to rely on means of communication such as this one, which is fine, but it's just not the same. It's a bit more difficult to, this is two-dimensional, whereas three dimensions or even four are better, right?
That's the challenge. Getting all the time, and I was going to ask you about that. You were traveling to sell, for business development mostly, I imagine, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So everybody now is trying to, you know, at least for the time being, do business development online. So the challenge you have is connecting in a human way through an online channel. Is that correct? Is that what
yes.
you're
talking? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's not the same. It's very, very different. This is very good operationally. They actually are very effective. You just get things done, right? It's very good for very, like I said, digital communication. This or that. Do
right.
this, and then I do that, right? But when it's
like
something that requires
the binary equation is easy online. Yeah.
Exactly. I give you an example. Like we're using Zoom right now. Zoom is useless if you want to play a concert. You want to play music with people. You can't do it, right? That one second delay that we have just makes music rendering completely impossible, right?
Right.
So this is it's a metaphor of how difficult it is to do things which are not very strict when it comes to this, right? If it's a matter of coordination, what I say or what I play, what you play, it just doesn't work.
Right.
So it's a metaphor of what we're missing in this new world of communication. That additional dimension is very important, and you need it for business development, you need it for coordination, you need it for to inspire confidence, or even gain confidence when I'm talking to someone, right?
Yeah.
It's very good for communicating facts. It's very good. I mean, I can teach online. I've been teaching online, no problem. You can do that. For teaching, it's not so much required, but if you have to give someone personal advice as to what to do, then that's where, you know, the human element is very hard to transmit through a medium like this.
Well, the world is still helping you, right? Because all of the audiences and everybody's just, you know, accepting the online connection much more. You know, when a lot of advisors tell me, you know, you had to, you know, I have to travel. I can't connect with a 60-something or 70-something-year-old that has, you know, a large that is high net worth, they're not going to get online to talk to me. You know, I have to be there for them. Now, those same guys, they had to get online to connect with their, you know, their grandchildren and their kids. And, you know, they had to do it.
Absolutely. My mother became an expert overnight on how to use this. Right. So it's like not a problem. It's not that hard. You know, you just need to have the will to actually do it.
Exactly. Yeah. So in the last few months, what's the biggest surprise you've had? You know, in the markets, in the business, in, you know, in your personal life, you want to,
the biggest surprise. Yeah. So I'll say or something. I mean, I just mentioned how difficult it is to do anything like truly human through this, but, through the pandemic, it was very reassuring to see, a lot of very human elements come to the surface, you know, in this crazy world that we're living in right now. So to me, that was very reassuring that as an animal species, you know, we have the right chemical elements to continue to work and continue to interact with each other despite bad things happening, right? There was a sentence by Giuliani when during September 11, he was mayor of New York, when he said that, you know, there was these firefighters going up the World Trade Center just before it was going to collapse, right?
Right.
And there were stories of people who said, you know, we're all trying to calm down and these crazy guys are going up, right? Mm-hmm. And they actually went up to their death. And to a certain sense, this is why we exist as an animal species, right? Not all animals will do that. Animals are classified according to different criteria, social criteria, and humans are at the top of that scale. Okay, and actually they say, and I'll say this just out loud, one of the reasons that we exist as an animal species is because we share germs more than another animal. It's actually true. We are eusocial. That's the word they use. So now, of course, sharing germs is a very bad thing right now. You know, we're trying to do the opposite, but this is very unnatural to us. We're actually, as animals, we've been designed to share germs, and this has been key to the survival of our species going forward. So I hope it doesn't change. You know, I hope we find the vaccine and the cure for COVID-19. Yeah, sure. But I hope a lot of that, the way we work, where we share germs, stays, because this is what has made us stronger over the years.
Yeah, that's the herd immunity everybody is rooting for, right? Mm-hmm. So in asset management, you know, you've had your many years of experience. Where do you feel you go against everybody else? Tell me something that, you know, it's true to you that nobody agrees with you on.
Most of what I say is not very popular. So I have to pick one thing, you know. So I'll tell you something that I say, and sometimes it actually comes out the wrong way, or people understand it the wrong way. But in the asset management, it's all about obtaining returns. It's about, you know, it's about profitability. And what I'm saying is you can't do that unless you take risks. You can't do that, okay? Investing without risk does not exist. So that's already unpopular. But then I go a step beyond. I said, if you're going to understand the profitability, you have to understand the risks that you're taking. I'm making that equation. No, understand that. So risk leads to return. You have to understand that equation. And that is, it's not that I go against everybody on this. I'm sure there's many people who agree with me, but this is not how people think. People are very hung up on what they think is the likely event. This is what I think is going to happen. So I have to prepare for that. And if you do that, I mean, you're going to be wrong more often than you're going to be right. So I don't think that's the very good approach. It's better to think, you know, what could go wrong? And if that happens, you know, what will my portfolio look like? So that, and it's not pessimism, it's just, it's scenario generation. That's
And how do you work this conversation with clients? Because most advisors will tell you that that's the hardest conversation to have.
Yeah, exactly. So as you can imagine, clients don't like to hear the word risk or the word, you know, something could go bad, right? So perhaps from a sales perspective, this is the wrong way to approach, but I think it's the honest approach, it's the right approach. It's you have to be equipped with good information so you can make the right decisions. Optimism is great. We need it as humans to, you know, feel good and survive. But when you're going to be doing something which has, when you're doing something which is important, you're investing, you're driving an airplane, you're operating on a patient, optimism has no role there. It has to be fact driven, right? So get all the facts and then act accordingly. And if it doesn't sound good, well, this is where storytelling is again, is good for entertainment. But that's the area that is that I am a big proponent of, and it seems that it's hard to communicate.
How would you rate the industry on honesty since you brought it up?
The word honesty is very hard. I mean, it's very hard to rate honesty. It's very hard to put those two concepts in the same sentence. You know, rate honesty. I find it difficult. But let me answer a slightly a related question, which is how much does this industry like facts and figures? And I would say up until a few years ago, not very much, but now they are. And this is one of the things that artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of that is bringing to us, which is people are being able to make the connection between data, which is there, sometimes isolated, and conclusions, right? Data and information, that connection is very, very important. It's very hard to do. But I think the industry is evolving very well forward on the connection between data and information. Mm-hmm. So it's improving. It's improving.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think the industry is evolving in terms of the connection between technology and the human touch? So
I'm sure.
How are we working on implementing technology in wealth management? Without losing that human connection that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. No. The industry. So it depends which industry you're talking about. If you're talking about the financial industry, the financial industry is very far behind. You're talking about the technology industry that is already doing that. I mean, people now can't live without
financial and wealth management.
The financial industry, I think, is very, very far behind when it comes to the use of technology, and you mentioned also the human element to that. The human element is extremely complex because we're talking about something which is, you know, the human element could be, you could be talking about art, you could be talking about crime. If they're all human. Right.
Yeah.
The connection of bringing the investment industry, the wealth management is very human. I would say that there's no deficiency there, but the technology adoption is very, very slow. It's not very deep, and it's giving a lot of companies a lot of problems, and especially companies who are very heavily regulated, like banks, for example. They're making it very difficult to. And when they do become technology, then the risks that come with technology, like cybersecurity, they become suddenly important, and you have to deal with them, and they don't know how to many of them, right? So technology is a source of trouble as much as it's a source of solutions right now. Challenges are huge in the technology area for the financial industry.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I see how just the legacy systems and the integration of the regulation and the new technologies are just creating headaches that people are not able, like financial institutions are not able to just go through. And but very few also are capable of capable of actually integrating their technology into a humanly fulfilling experience for the people. So you either have an app or you have pen and paper and a person to see at the branch. But the integration between those two experiences, that's where, you know, that's where the industry is failing.
Yeah, it's a challenge. And if you add to that all the complexities that now come from privacy laws and privacy issues, and it just becomes something very, very difficult to manage.
Exactly.
It's a big challenge, yeah.
So I want to close with a couple of quick, fun questions. If heaven exists, what would you like God to say when you arrive?
Wow. That I was right, maybe. Whatever it was. Whatever that may be. I mean, it's... I've been, you know, saying a lot of things through my life, and many of them they proved to be right only after a period of time. So that would be a nice thing to hear.
And if you could have a billboard with anything on it, what would it be and why?
Oh, the people that I like, the people that I love. That would be nice. Again, I feel that the human element has to be everywhere in everything we do. So.
Yeah. Completely agree on that one. Okay, Luis, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you for so much for your time, and hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, anytime. It was very rewarding. Thank you very much.